Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. This time, University of Wisconsin at Madison historian and author Etheline Whitmire talks about her book, The Remarkable Life of Reed Pegram, The Man Who Stared Down World War II in the Name of Love. It was published by Viking this month, and Whitmire was interviewed by fellow biographer and bio member Eric K. Washington.
Etheline Whitmire, congratulations on this wonderful biography.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for writing it. So why don't we start with a brief recap of who was Reed Pegram?
Yes, Reed Pegram was an African-American man, a gay man from Boston, born in 1914. He came from a very modest background. His father actually kind of worked as a poet, an entertainer. His mother didn't initially work until after the parents divorced, and then she did do some cleaning, but he was primarily raised by his grandmother, who did house cleaning. So he came from a very modest background, but yet he ended up attending Boston Latin School and Harvard and Columbia University in the 1930s, at a time when it wasn't common for many Americans to go to college, much less Black Americans in great numbers. And so he came from a modest background, but had a lot of ambition. He wanted to be a college professor. He loved literature. He loved the arts. He loved opera, music. He wanted to study abroad. He wanted to live a very interesting life. And for the most part, he was able to do that until World War II intervened.
Yeah. And he was Bostonian, right?
Right. He was born in Dorchester. And raised. Both of his parents migrated separately up from Virginia to the Boston area.
Okay. And what compelled you to write about him?
I just found his story to be so interesting. He is part of a larger project of me looking at African Americans in Denmark. I just happened to go there on a whim when I was writing my first biography about Regina Anderson Andrews, Harlem Renaissance librarian. And I started physically seeing signs of African Americans in Denmark by looking at gravestones or discovering people buried there, but also just when I was reading about other biographies of Black people, I read about this Thyra Edwards who spent time there. And so I decided to write a book about African Americans in Denmark. But when I decided to do that, I had to figure out, well, how do I know who was in Denmark? And I started looking at the historical Black newspapers, searching on ProQuest, and Reed Pegram's story just popped up in these intriguing headlines about a Harvard student, a doctoral student studying in Paris, captured by the Nazis, escaping. And I just found it fascinating. And I'm very interested in people who are unsung, people that you've never heard about. And so I just really wanted to tell a story. I thought of all the people in my African Americans in Denmark book that I was writing that he was the most interesting of them all.
And I have to say, I was fortunate last year. I got to see the exhibit that you curated at Scandinavia House, Nordic Utopia, about African Americans in Scandinavian countries. Now, I don't recall Reed Pegram being part of that exhibit, was he?
He wasn't, because unfortunately there wasn't a painting. There's no way to really represent him. But he was
certainly part of the context that led you to discovering him. How did you actually come across him?
Just when I was searching the newspapers for the words Denmark, Copenhagen, and I knew a lot of people went to Elsinore too, his name just popped up. And then I tried to do more searching on him. There's very little. There's now a Wikipedia page, but that's only because one of my students created the Wikipedia page. So I decided to contact Harvard. That might have been the first step to try to get their records. They had almost 200 pages of his records from his undergraduate program for his master's program. I had to wait to get the doctoral degree program because there's a moratorium for so many years. I don't know if it was 75 or 80 years before you could access all the documents. And so Fortunately or unfortunately, I was working on this long enough that the time, expired, and I was able to get all of his documents from the time when he was a doctoral student also. So I started there, and then I contacted the Boston Latin School. I just realized lately that he didn't really have an archive. I'm basically creating an archive trying to get all of these things together. And then I found out from one of his relatives that his family had 200 letters that he wrote from Paris, from Copenhagen, and from Florence. And then that really opened up this book.
Well, I'm going to circle back to that when we start talking about some of your process. But you did mention your previous biography about another bibliophile, not so much collector, but book lover, Regina Andrews Anderson, the Harlem Renaissance librarian and renowned race woman. Was Pegram similar, or were there differences that were of interest to you?
At first I thought that they were very different. When I look back at Reed being at Columbia, he was in New York City at the same time that Regina Andrews was there, and he even went to Harlem to get his hair cut while he was at Columbia. But what I see is similar is their interest in traveling abroad, like Regina Andrews traveled, interest in the arts. She was more interested in writing plays, performing in plays, and Reed liked to attend and watch plays. But they were just people who, both of them, who were just interested in not living a conventional life, living an interesting life. Regina left Chicago to go to New York City and then became part of the Harlem Renaissance. And so she knew all the major players, like County Colon and Langston Hughes. And so they had similarities. I don't know if they would have hung out with each other. But they did have a very interesting connections, though she came from a very elite background. Her father was a famous defense attorney in Chicago, and so she came from more privilege than he did.
Do you know if they cross paths?
Nothing indicates that they ever crossed paths or that he ever went to any of the libraries where she was at, so
But
no.
he and Langston crossed paths, did they not?
They
Or
were in London around the same time, and
that?
so they were written about in the black newspapers, and so I don't think he met Langston, but it's interesting that Reed was so proud to be mentioned in the same breath. And I thought it was interesting because later, when I looked at the books that he read at the Shakespeare and Company Library, the bookstore in Paris, he took out books, but he didn't take out any books by any African American authors. And first, I thought maybe he wasn't familiar with them, being at Harvard, I'm sure they weren't teaching Black author courses at that time. But he knew who Langston Hughes was, so he was aware of some of the Black authors that existed.
So he went to Boston Latin School, which, although it was a local school for him, it's also a very, very famous school with famous alumni going back to what, 17th century? Yes, 18th century.
I think they celebrate 300 years. So what would that be?
And he
Yeah.
went to Harvard and graduated Phi Beta Kappa.
Yes.
Then he goes to Europe and goes to the Sorbonne.
Yes.
So these are all sort of marquee named
Yes.
institutions. And he goes there on a Rosenwald Fellowship, which
Yes.
Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes also were recipients of. So Pegram seems voraciously curious, and Europe awaited his insatiable appetite for cultural adventure like a grand buffet. It's a variety of arts, languages, food, travel, and intellectual experiences fed both Pegram's sensibilities, but also his scholarship. He wrote impressively about those things from what you write. And you wrote that Pegram was always on the make, looking for a benefactor. And he seems acutely aware of the power of his own charm.
Yes.
He observes about himself, it's funny, really. I can get almost anywhere I want to socially. And if only I had a way of living without being kept by other people, I probably would have become something already. So is there an inference that I'm getting, by his own admission, that he's, something of a courtesan?
I don't know if I would go that
Maybe
far,
that's
but
kind of
he did.
formal. Yeah.
Right, but he did. Should I say he didn't want to work? I think he wanted to be able to write, to explore things, and really be engaged with the finer things in life from somewhere, somehow, some money. his grandmother was the one who was actually his benefactor. He even had the nerve to brag to her that he's been able to survive without working for quite a while. I said, "You are talking to the person who has supported you." So he does indicate that he wants to get a patron like who supported Zora Neale Hurston and Langston Hughes,
Like
right? The
Charlotte
famous.
Mason,
So I think he was looking for something like that. I don't know if it had to be within a relationship, but he was hoping that someone would see him as being very talented and wanted to support him in the lifestyle that he wanted to become accustomed to.
But he is charming enough that I mean, people do indulge him, and you do write that he does get gifts of money, people helping him out. It's not like it's a payment for like a transactional thing, but he meets minor royalty. He's invited to sup with people. So he's
Yes.
clearly of interest to people.
He seems to be very charming. People remember him when he was in Paris. He said that he ran into some people from Boston who remembered him. He didn't remember them. I think he hinted that, I'm one of the few black people who might have been there at the symphony. So of course they remember me, but he didn't remember. But then people sought him out, other Harvard people when they were in Paris. So he seems to be very charming and engaging. I just wish I could find more resources of people writing about him. I mean, he writes very highly of himself. So mostly I have just those letters that he wrote about his experiences and not so much from other people.
And he doesn't, he interacts personally with a host of notable figures on both sides of the pond. The artist who you mentioned, Thomas Handforth, who does that wonderful portrait, and Valeta Snow, who I knew about, the jazz queen of the trumpet, who spent part of World War II imprisoned in a Nazi-occupied Denmark. And he meets on this side of the pond composer Leonard Bernstein, with whom Pegram made unrequited romantic overtures. And I guess that was early in Bernstein's career, before it was widely known that he was gay or bisexual. So he met a lot of folks who a lot of other people would know.
Steven Spender even.
But yes, I was excited to see that Isherwood was one of the books that he kept checking out. But it's Danish artist Arne Hauptmann, am I saying it right, who he meets in Paris, who becomes Pegram's soulmate. And through thick and thin, much of it thin, they seem to remain steadfast through the adversities of the Great Depression, the impending European War, German Nazi invasion, and Italian fascist concentration camps from which they make this thrilling escape. Talk about them, the two of them together, about their meeting and their companionship and their partnership.
So it was interesting while I was reading the letters and reading through Paris. At first, Arne didn't appear, but he did appear to the very end of almost at the end of the time that Reed was there studying, sometime towards May. And it seemed like it was just a very brief but very intense relationship. Reed talked about spending lots of time in the apartment with Arne cooking for him. And then they made plans when Arne left to go back to Denmark for them to meet again. And so a few months later, they met. And they hung out in Copenhagen for 7 months, but this was shortly before World War II started. But it was such an intense relationship that Reed, though he had opportunities to leave to save his life, even when he arrived in Paris in 1938, the United States was already warning Americans to leave, but he had longed to always go to Paris. So he said, "I'll just stay until the first bombs, come down," and he would hope he would survive. But he just really loved and was devoted to Arne, and they stayed together for the entire World War II, not just in Denmark, but also in Italy under some very trying circumstances. But he just felt an intense loyalty towards him.
You bring us, from country to country as they're trying to dodge the authorities and get papers for Arne to be able to come to the US. And so it's kind of a thrilling travelogue in its way as they're moving about until they're both stopped, separated, and imprisoned separately at first, and before they're able to kind of reconnect. It's so cinematic. And it's funny, despite Pegram's worldly sophistication, how did he feel to see the looming threat of Hitler's war?
He knew it was coming, but I think he was in denial. He said that in one of the letters he wrote to his family that people in Europe will have to live through the war, so why shouldn't he still be there? It was just very unrealistic, but yeah, it's hard to believe that he wouldn't have left. I think, keep thinking personally, I would have said, "I love you. Good luck. I'll see you later. I hope you survive the war." But he refused to leave. Again, it was very unrealistic, I think.
It was honorable, and I noted to myself, I said, I wondered if this blind spot was due to Pegram's political naivete, Or was it a fiercely romantic denial of any potential threat to his aspired artist's life, which
I
he
think
had?
that's what it was. The fiercely romantic denial. I mean, there was one letter that he wrote that was confiscated by the authorities in Italy, where he talked about what was going on politically in Italy, and he seemed to be very abreast, kept abreast of the news. And so he knew people were closing in and he had the opportunity, but he was just frustratingly. He just wouldn't leave. And I thought some of the most interesting letters were the ones with the Rosenwald Foundation, where people were trying to talk to them on Reed's behalf. Like one man said, I don't know if you know about this guy, Reed Pagram. And one man said, there are no end to the letters about this young man. Even, over 80 years later, I can feel the rage or the frustration from the Rosenwald Foundation, who
You
I didn't
barely
really.
alienated them, I would say, right?
Yes. And I was so surprised. You get these letters doing research later, how much they went out of their way to actually help him, and he could have been saved a long time earlier.
And I kind of leaned to the side that it was probably more denial than naivete, because kind of going back to Harvard. When he's corresponding with them, I thought, well, no, he seems fairly politically astute about the American politics. And when he appeals to the Harvard appointment office for teaching position recommendations and says, I should refuse any state south of Virginia. So he seemed acutely aware of the zeitgeist
Yes.
in the US, being black, being gay, of the potential dangers to him in the South, albeit naive about Harvard then recommending him as a black person, to anywhere other than an HBCU in the South.
Right. When he talked about where they could live if Erna was able to go, they talked about major cities, whether it's Boston or New York. So I think he felt that it would be safer or better environment for them to be together. He didn't mention any small towns. So I think, yeah, he knew about those dangers.
So let's talk about your process. I mean, how long did it take for you to work on the book?
Yeah, it's hard to say because I first discovered the stories about African Americans in Denmark in maybe 2012. And I wasn't necessarily ready to start writing about it until a few years later. But I got the book contract in 2022 after I got an agent, and the agent said, I should work on this one story about African Americans in Denmark. And so at first I thought, oh, one story, how hard could that be to write one biography instead of the group biography? Don't ask me why I thought that when I already did another biography that took years. So I had already written an article about Reed Pagram in 2018. I was testing the waters to see if people were interested in my writing outside of academia, but I was planning to put that aside. And I thought, oh, maybe someone will pick that up and write about Reed Pagram, but I'm glad it's me. Now, but I did put that aside for a while until 2022 when I started writing in earnest and finished it in 2025, with production now is coming out in 2026.
And what archives did you find? I know you said there's no central archive.
I use things like ArchiveGrid to find letters that he sent to other people, or I found letters that he sent to the editor, Dorothy Norman. And at first, I found that, okay, so he wrote to an editor of a journal. How interesting could that be in the Yale archives? But that was while he was in France and in Italy, and he talked about Erna and he talked about his life during this war-torn era. And so that opened up things. I also got government records from Denmark, National Archives. France was the most frustrating. It was like pulling teeth. I barely got anything from there. But the Italian archives, at first, I put in a request. I did put it in English. Maybe that was naive. And then I used Google Translate to put it in Italian. And everything opened up almost overnight. They sent me several files, hundreds and hundreds of documents about Erna and about Reed during their time in Italy, their times being observed by officials, records about their internment. All of that opened up. So I got, again, things from professional organizations, also from institutions, from Columbia. Again, Harvard was very generous. What was frustrating to me is I had another friend who was working on biography at the same time, and she was interviewing all these people. And I'm like, how come I'm not interviewing people? And I realized most of his friends were gay men at a time when people didn't marry, so they didn't have children, and there were no offspring to have their collection of letters. There were no offspring to interview about, oh, when your father knew Reed Pagram, what was that like? Or did he ever mention Reed? And so that was what's frustrating, but also very sad about gay history, how difficult it is to sometimes recreate because of these gaps. What was actually interesting was to try to figure out who people were. And at a point, some point, he kept talking about the kittens. I'm like, who are the kittens? And every time names came up, I would try to figure out who they were. And I was like, well, who is Cyril and who is Ogie? And trying to figure out who they were until one day he said what Ogie's real name was, his first name, and where he taught at a university. And when I looked that name up, I got his unusual hyphenated last name. And then when I Googled that, along with Cyril, because at some point I realized, oh, he only mentions those two men together. He never says Cyril's doing this or oh. I was like, they're a couple. And then finally, when I did all the research, found out there's a nearly 40-year love affair. But when you look at their obituaries, there's nothing to indicate that they even knew each other. But when you look in the archives, when you look in the records of the ancestry.com and you look at the census records, they live together as cousins, supposedly, though they're not even from the same country. And so I also found that the man he stayed with during World War II in Denmark, when a Danish genealogist helped me find stuff, found out that when he died, he thanked a good friend who he lived with for like 23 years. I'm like, who has a 23-year roommate? There's got to be more than something going on. But in the obituary, just said his good friend, and I can actually read that in Danish. And so I said, there's all this history that's obscured.
Now, you were fortunate in that you had, circling back now, a lot of personal correspondences from the family. So I think you were speaking in Denmark and there was somebody in the audience and away. It was so marvelous.
Well, it was weird. I was doing some research on Audre Lorde in Berlin, and I met a Black American woman, Denise, who's kind of a gatherer of people, mainly people of color. She has parties. And then I left America. She went to Austria. In Austria, she met a Black American woman, Teju, again, gathering of people. And then she knew that Teju and I were we were going to Copenhagen in the fall of 2016. And I know Teju was very interested in Black history, so I invited her to my talk about African Americans in Denmark. And after I presented during the Q&A, she raised her hand and she said, "Reed Pagram, that's my great uncle." She didn't know him because she was too young, but she recognized his photos from photos around the house. And then she said, "I have more to tell you." And then she came to my office at the University of Copenhagen, where I was on the Fulbright, and she told me about these letters that the family had. And I assumed it was a few letters. I had no idea there would be 200 letters written during this time period.
That's
And they're not archived. They were in a binder that his niece, the aunt of Teju, had. And so she was able to send, snapshots when she had time. And so it took a little while to get them all, but it was just a fascinating history. Most of them were typed because he was a writer. He took his typewriter everywhere, but they're not easy to carry, but he took it everywhere. He said it was his meal ticket. He hoped to be a famous writer. He hoped to write a book, the book that I've written now, about his own life. And so it was amazing to get these letters.
Had the family read the letters or did they just keep them?
Well, obviously the correspondence were mainly his grandmother, sometimes his mother, when his grandmother was mad at him, especially about not coming back to America. And then the niece, her name is Deb Farrar Parkman. She seemed to have read the letters over the years, and but as she's reread them recently, as she gave them to me. But I don't know if anyone else in the family had read the letters.
That was so generous of them.
Yeah, and Deb is actually working on a documentary. She started to get funding and grants. She's still in Boston in the home where he lived, where he died. And so she has a background in journalism and she's planning to create a documentary.
Well, what things surprised you the most in researching and writing his biography?
Just that there was this Black man who, at this time of life, born in again 1914, who seemed so very confident. He wasn't naive about racism, but he seemed to almost like didn't want it to bother him or was just surging forward in his plans. He didn't seem to worry about being stopped because of race. Obviously, he didn't know what was written in the documents that were in the appointment office files, but he just lived his life as full as he could without the barriers. And I liked his confidence. He didn't feel like I'm a second-class citizen because I was black. He actually might have been a little overconfident, but I guess you had to be that way in order to be successful at that time. He thought a lot of himself. He thought he was very talented, thought he was very smart, thought he had a lot to give. And I really liked that confidence that he had. And that, I guess, was most surprising. But he also kind of also knew he was a little cocky too. So in some of his letters, he would acknowledge that. But sometimes he says, I, Mom, I'm a very unusual person. But he, I think, actually liked that.
There are always silences, when you're researching history. Were there some things that you still were just never able to nail down, or that you're, even though the book is out, you're still questing to discover?
Yes, I wanted to know how did other people really perceive him besides the instructors at Harvard who wrote things in the appointment letters. Again, it was impossible to find records from his friends. If you recall, one of his friends died tragically in his 20s. Then one man who we know was gay, Tony Sabansky, or the Count, he also died very young at 40, 41, and there aren't records. But it's funny, he had one close friend who was heterosexual, his friend Newton. He did marry, but then didn't have any children. And then he also died tragically, hit by a car. I'm not sure what is happening with all his friends, but there weren't many records of people that I could interview other than his niece. But his nephew was like a son to read. And he actually it was a college professor. And so I did talk to him about Reed Pagram. I wish that there were audio of him. I wish that there were video of him. I wondered how he walked, how he talked, though I got a sense from some of the photos and just from his writing. And also the reporters said, he says he's from Dorchester, but he sounds British. He wrote using British spellings. After he was freed, he was dressed in a way that looked very elegant, like he was at a dinner party and not like he just got out of the concentration camp. So I have a sense of maybe his bearing and how he would be, but I really wish that I could see a video of him.
Right. How is Reed Pegram germane to today's political climate of cultural erasure?
Well, what's interesting is that there were two lawsuits at two of the institutions where he went, the Boston Latin School, where Black parents were wondering how come in the 21st century, how come there are not more Black students who are enrolled in this elite institution? And then Harvard had a lawsuit too about affirmative action, as if there were too many Black people at Harvard, which, they're not. So people are still pushing back. And I look at this man who's succeeded and was successful because he was given an opportunity and given a chance. There wasn't affirmative action back then, but he just had the opportunity to be in both of these spaces, and he succeeded as far as he could given the circumstances. And I feel like it speaks to even today that how people should be given chances to be in these spaces. And I hope that people will have the kind of confidence. They don't have to be cocky like him, but have a kind of confidence. Or also, I think there are African Americans who pursue interests that might not be what you consider the typical. And so I feel like we can give people permission to live the life that they want.
So now that you know how long it can take, any advice to first-time biographers who might be approaching a subject of similar scope?
You have to be passionate about your subject because it will take several years. And after I wrote about Regina Anderson Andrews, I loved her story. I loved following in her footsteps. And I thought I would never find another subject like that until I found Reed. And I'm just as passionate about his life, putting these puzzle pieces together. And I couldn't imagine writing a biography on someone that you just so about, because you have to be relentless in trying to find as many resources as you can, just driven on like a detective. So you have to really like to do that kind of work and just be curious and passionate about what you do.
Well, I thank you for writing this book, and I think it's important on so many levels. It's American history, it's Black history, it's LGBTQ history, and it's just damned interesting,
It is. I
and
think
it
so.
may even be cinematic history,
I hope so.
Thank you so
Exactly.
much, Ethelene.
Thank
Appreciate
you for
it.
inviting me. I appreciate it too.
That was African American Studies professor and author Etheline Whitmire talking with Eric K. Washington about her book, The Remarkable Life of Reed Pegram, The Man Who Stared Down World War II in the Name of Love. It was published by Viking this month, and this interview was recorded via Zoom in January of this year. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellian Marie Fillengaines created our theme music. Jenny Skoog is our producer. Carolyn Van Putten, assistant producer. And Shereen Newman is our engineer. I'm executive producer Sonia Williams. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day. Thank you.